Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. You know, if there's a silver lining to come out of the pandemic, it's probably this, and it may sound crazy, but the pandemic has actually created market forces that for the moment are pushing up wages for some of the lowest paid, most underpaid, and most essential workers in our economy. And it turns out, according to Washington Post columnist Ishan Tharoor, that it's not just in the United States. Ishan will join us in just a second. This slightly improved environment for some of the most taken advantage of workers in the wealthiest nations is fascinating for any number of reasons. But one of them, for me, was to learn from Ishan's column that it's happening in Europe, too. Because the other big thing that's going on in this country right now, as you know, is President Biden trying to get his next generation social supports bill passed, what they call the human infrastructure or a Build Back Better bill. It really needs a name. But in aiming for new child care and elder care and paid family leave and college access programs, we always hear that we'd be catching up with Europe, right? So it's interesting to me to see that this up our stinky wages movement is going on over there too. So we'll talk to Washington Post Global Affairs columnist Ishan Tharoor about that and about the preview that he wrote up of the big upcoming climate summit in Scotland. Ishan, always great to have you on the show. I always learn stuff when you're on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian. It's such a pleasure to be with you.
The headline on that column is "The Great Resignation Goes Global." Can you remind us briefly what the term "the Great Resignation" refers to and what's driving it?
Right. Well, so the Great Resignation is a term that we've heard in over the last few months here in the U.S. describing what is essentially still very much a uniquely American phenomenon. Basically, this year, starting roughly around spring, economists and those who track the American labor market have noticed steady and really, at this point, record numbers of Americans leaving their jobs. You had 4 million in April, and then a record 4.3 million in August. And of course, significant similar numbers in between. And so this idea of the Great Resignation is of course, tethered to the pandemic, tethered to the fact that a lot of these people leaving these jobs are leaving jobs that were either, you know, in difficult conditions or relatively low paid. And many of these people had, had a bit of a boost from government spending programs that gave them an infusion of cash. Many of them also recognized during the pandemic that maybe they don't want to be working in the context that they've been working for so long. And now what we're seeing is, especially in recent months, that there is a lot of the reason why people are leaving their jobs is because they have the opportunity to get higher wages elsewhere. That there is a kind of, because of the way in which the pandemic hit the country, it led to a lot of layoffs, it led to a lot of businesses contracting, but now demand is back. The economy is worrying again in various ways. Of course, there's some real problems. A lot of businesses are finding that there are major shortages of labor, and they're finding that they need to be more competitive in recruiting people. And so the Great Resignation, if from one angle, it's worrying because obviously it impacts the productivity of the American economy. But on the other hand, and this is what a lot of labor rights activists are saying, is that the Great Resignation comes as a kind of correction, yes, to a much longer and prolonged stagnation, a kind of greater stagnation in the wages and benefits of the American, of those in,
right,
the lower end of the American economy.
As you remind us in the column, the Great Resignation in the United States was preceded by a far greater stagnation in worker wages and benefits as workers lost bargaining power over decades, which is probably one of the most common things we've ever talked about on the show and what to do about it. And you include a really interesting tweet from your Washington Post colleague, the economics reporter Heather Long, who notes workers who switch jobs, and workers, if you don't like your job, take note, workers who switch jobs almost always earn bigger raises than those who stay at the same firm. and that gap is now the widest it's been in two decades. But let me get to the idea that I set up in the intro, which is for you as a global affairs columnist, you point out that in Western Europe, with its social democracies, a stronger safety net has led to less disruption, but still similar trends are at play. So can you describe some of the European manifestations of these labor shortages and other trends?
Right, absolutely. So we're not seeing something on the scale of what's happening in the US, but the pandemic is a global phenomenon, and invariably it's hitting various economies in similar ways. So for example, the UK has a major labor shortage issue as well. They had, I think in the summer, it was posting the largest number of vacancies it's ever had in their economy. The sort of German Minister for Federal Employment, the German Federal Minister for Employment has recently said that the country now is in a situation where it needs to be importing hundreds of thousands of skilled workers every year to make up shortfalls that they're not seeing in their economy. Also in Germany, which is of course Europe's largest national economy, you're seeing a situation where it's factories and it's meat processing industry, it's kind of lower end agricultural sectors have been massively hit by the pandemic because they're not getting the same kind of cheap labor from Central and Eastern Europe that came to work in factories in Northern Europe and Western Europe. And so now there's a whole issue around incentivizing higher pay for industrial workers as well. And so that kind of course correction that's happening across these liberal democracies, where you have seen wages stagnate in various ways, does seem to be happening. I don't think we can invoke the same frame of the Great Resignation to fit entirely there. But as you said, there is this sense that, okay, we're in a moment now, and this is perhaps part of a much lengthier and political engagement that we've been in over sort of what national economy should look like, how workers' rights can bolster payments. And I think this is a moment for organized labor. You're seeing strikes across the U.S. You're seeing trade unions really take the lead in certain places. The German election that just happened a few weeks ago was won by the center-left, the party that has the strongest backing of the trade union movement there. These are concerns that are on everyone's minds. And so the pandemic has created this interesting moment for workers' rights. Now, we'll see, especially as other pressures come to bear, inflationary ones as well, how long the kind of political center of gravity will center on workers' concerns as opposed to the concerns
right.
of business.
So the similarities with the U.S. are interesting. The differences with the U.S. are interesting. And, of course, the big U.S. political story right now, and I'm going to ask Cory Booker one question about this coming up in our next segment, is President Biden's push for making the social safety net here more like Europe's, especially for child care and elder care and paid family leave. And by the way, listeners, coming up later this hour, I meant to mention it at the top, we're going to continue our New York, New Jersey geography quiz series that we're doing in the fall membership drive. And our guest quiz leader for your New Jersey geography questions will be Senator Cory Booker. So that's coming up in a little while. Ishan Tharoor, Washington Post global affairs columnist with me right now. And let me go to the other recent column of yours that caught my eye and that I know you're very interested in talking about. This is from last Friday, about the upcoming climate summit in Scotland known as, do they say COP26 or COP26?
I think it's COP26, yes.
And we'll cover it closely when it happens. But can you preview what this summit is supposed to be for?
So this is, of course, a major kind of moment in the global struggle against climate action. Against climate change, you're going to have dozens of world leaders, maybe over 100 world leaders convening there. You're going to see close to 30,000 delegates arrive from the political world, public sector, private sector, multinational companies, even celebrities. It's going to be a kind of Davos on steroids around climate change, all taking place in Glasgow. And this is, of course, a UN conference that is designed to essentially reset the world's battle on climate change. to gin up new commitments from various governments as well as the private sector on curbing emissions. And it has been billed for months in advance as kind of this last moment, this kind of rallying moment for the world to reckon with a warming planet and to address the kind of goals and commitments that were made in 2015 at the Paris Climate Accords, where governments committed to this this very kind of abstract target, but that one that is very real for our climate, which is preventing a rise of temperatures above this figure of 1.5 degrees Celsius or around 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. And that right now looks like a pretty tough ask. And so what my column argued, and which is it was essentially making the point that there is a mounting kind of pessimism surrounding this conflict, not just because what is intended to be the target of the Glasgow summit is already a difficult ask, but because we're not seeing the kind of commitments that we need to even get close to being on track. And so, for example, you have a study that came out today that essentially said that, you know, the world has to basically stop adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere by 2050. And we're nowhere close to doing that. The U.S., for example, has been, and this is a work of the Biden administration, they've been really leading the charge on cutting carbon and setting up a scenario where the bulk of the American economy is producing clean electricity by the end of this coming decade. But politically, that's proving a very difficult ask. And if the U.S. cannot manage that politically, and we're seeing this right now in the wranglings over the reconciliation bill, then what? How can the U.S. go and lecture to China and India about the commitments they need to be making around coal? This summit was supposed to be kind of the end of coal. There are big declarations made about how after Glasgow, the world will be committing to essentially phase out coal as quickly as possible. And that does not look like it's going to happen this time. So rather than coming away with a kind of renewed sense of collective action on climate change, we're very likely to see acrimony. We're very likely to see the gaps and the differences between governments on how to go forward.
You report that John Kerry, along these lines, who is President Biden's climate envoy, has been traveling to places including Mexico and Saudi Arabia in advance of the summit. Why there?
Well, he's been traveling to a lot of places. So Mexico and Saudi Arabia, of course, are major fossil fuel extractors and sellers. And so I think he's hoping to get some kind of top-line commitments from them before the summit. He's been doing the same. He's been shuttling around the world to various capitals, to a lot of the Gulf Arab kingdoms that are major oil producers, of course, to India, to China. He's been on the front lines of this, and he's trying very hard to get new and significant commitments because there is a recognition that these major fossil fuel producers, as well as these consumers in India and China who are using coal to fire up their massive economies, need to be on board as the West also figures out how to transition as well. I mean, there are two parts of this. One is addressing the developing world and saying, okay, what can we do to wean you off your need for these fossil fuels right now? But the other and far more politically complicated exercise, and that first part is also politically complicated, is addressing your own economies and your own countries and saying, okay, look, we have to transition and we have to do it quickly. We have a very narrow window now, over basically the span of less than a generation to become essentially carbon zero or carbon neutral. And that will require a huge amount of investment, a huge amount of adaptation in the way we go about things that is technically complicated and politically even more fraught. And this climate summit is happening at a time where there's tremendous volatility in energy prices. Europe is getting ready for a winter where rising natural gas prices and heat costs may lead to real, like a whole wave of deaths because people can't afford their electricity bills. And so there are kind of more short-term concerns and short-term political concerns that will outweigh or obscure or undermine the need for a long-term collective vision.
And we're just about out of time, but I want you to end on one other thing that you put in your column on this that I think is so important and so fascinating. As we look at the current U.S. politics of climate and that same human infrastructure bill we were talking about a minute ago that includes elder care and child care and paid parental leave that would buffer people from the worst effects of a recession like we had during the pandemic, the height of the pandemic, that same bill, of course, includes a lot of climate protections, and it is maybe the main reason that Senator Joe Manchin is blocking the bill, because of course he represents the coal state of West Virginia. So we have Joe Manchin on the one hand single-handedly trying to rescue the coal industry and so far succeeding in the United States, and the rest of the world about to meet in Scotland to try to put an end to the environmentally very damaging coal industry. So what a conflict, Joe Manchin against the world. But in this respect, the climate summit politics and goals might actually run up against the human infrastructure bill goals. And the thing you put in the column that I find so relevant is for people who oppose climate controls because they say they cost the economy, you point out how climate change itself is already exacting a significant price on the American economy. Climate change itself. So give us about a half minute on that, and then we're out of time.
Right. There's a study that found that this year alone, the United States has experienced over a dozen extreme weather events that cost the American economy, at least individually, $1 billion each or more each time. We are in an age of climate change. We are experiencing this in various ways constantly, and that is only going to get worse. And so the question is, yes, we have to, the country needs to be ready to adapt to a warming planet. A lot of the damage has already been done, but there's a real social incentive to work on addressing the deteriorating weather effects. Because if we get above 1.75 degrees in warming, scientists, and there's no debate over this at this point, there's a profound amount of scientific consensus here, that our planet is in for troubling times, and it's going to be more vulnerable parts of the world that are worst hit, but the U.S. is already feeling it, and New Yorkers felt it this year in a really profound way with the flooding. And so this is there should be a kind of clarion call for all of us to recognize the need to get real and serious and focused on climate change.
Ishan Tharoor, global affairs columnist for The Washington Post. Ishan, we always really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Brian.